Record this. Hi, everyone. This is Sana Ahmed, the CEO of the Product Marketing Institute, and I am here with my guest, Wesley Faulkner. We're going to talk a bit shortly how he has been driving product marketing innovations in his career. A little quick introduction is that I have these thought leadership publications with the Product Marketing Magazine and Product Marketing Podcast, and I interview people that have been in the technology field and are specifically in specific product roles, and have these guests give their unique perspective of how they've been driving innovation from their roles, because product marketing is this huge a driver in terms of being able to develop products and take it to market. And the reality is also that product marketing doesn't rest on one person. It takes a village of people, and there's a lot of talented people that work behind the scenes to be able to take even one small product feature enhancement to market. And this is my goal, is to help the B2B technology industry understand all the different moving pieces and all the amazing people that work to make products happen and get it into the hands of customers. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Wesley. And Wesley, I'd love for you to give an introduction to the audience about yourself, what you've done, and we're going to dive deeper and deeper into some of the cool stuff you've been doing.
Yes, my name is Wesley Faulkner, as you said. I have had a long career of technology, both on the using side and the implementation side in different capacities. I started off as a hardware engineer, storage engineer for Dell. Did that for about 6 years. So go out to customer sites. If they, like if NASDAQ goes down, I would just get on a red eye and go fix their storage systems. Then I pivoted to working as a product development engineer for AMD. Did that for several years. And then during that experience, I got a passion for marketing and had multiple marketing roles, both agency, startup, and volunteer. Nonprofit side. So a variety of different sizes, customer bases, and products. But right now I'm a developer relations advocate. And so I work on more on the software and implementation side. So the tooling of creating all of the products that developers use in their everyday lives.
Can you talk a little bit more about what a developer relations role typically is for the audience? Because again, there's so many people that are involved in developing a product. It's more than just the product manager or the product marketer. There's so many people in between that entire process. Would love for you to just expand on that a little bit. And we were talking a little bit earlier too, where you were talking about all the different pieces that go into it. And so how do you kind of focus on which one to do and maybe when with all the different hats that you're wearing?
Yes. So developer relations can change with person to person, with company to company. It's almost like, what is a good opinion? there is no really good answer to that. But generally speaking, it's finding a way to laser in and talk to developers, the ones that would use your product. For instance, in terms of general marketing, developers are kind of skeptical because general marketing is more like, our thing is the best. Our thing is awesome. And people who make software find bugs and problems and think about all the edge cases where things fail. And so that type of marketing usually is really, really scrutinized by people who are very detail oriented. And people who are on the other end of the spectrum who are super hyper technical may not be able to convey general ideas because they are like an inch wide and a mile deep, because they are very specialized in their specific area. And so developer relations is kind of like a Venn diagram of combining marketing and technical prowess and expertise and communication to be able to market specifically to that segment in a way that is approachable and in a way that that finds them where they are. So speaking at conferences, writing blog posts, writing sample codes, even participating in open source projects. That's different ways that people can use developer relations to target their eventual customers or the users of their product.
That's pretty powerful. I'm learning, you know, this with you as you're explaining it to me. So it's a very multifaceted role then, where it's almost like a lot of technical communication, because most of the generalists that I work with do not have necessarily a technical background. Mm-hmm. And so you happen to have a technical background, and you're breaking it down into almost like layman's terms for the greater audience. And then from that audience, you're able to sort of hyper-focus on like the ones that are responding, and then sort of drill a little bit deeper into them, depending on what it is that they need to know. And that audience is specifically primarily developers, correct?
Yes. And if you're probably not familiar with developer relations, most people aren't, but think about the last time you heard someone who is extremely specialized in an area, but they're still able to talk to you as a person. Think about currently this pandemic. They have scientific experts kind of explaining things. Like they have, they're doctors, they have degrees, they have years and decades of experience, but yet they're able to communicate what matters to you and how it's relevant into your life. The same thing about when you hear an astronomer, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, those type of people who are super smart, but then they're able to relate, like Bill Nye. Like there are people who are highly technical in their field and still able to be relatable. Think of that in terms of developer relations.
That's actually, I'm smiling because growing up, I used to love watching Bill Nye, the science guy, and Mrs. Frizzle was my favorite teacher. I wish I had her in real life. The magic school bus. So let's jump into a little bit more now. Having wearing so many cross departmental hats and doing these multifunctions and taking very complex concepts and breaking them down is almost similar to what product marketing is. And I'd like to just take a moment to define product marketing from my perspective, and also hear product marketing from your perspective of developer relations, you also having an engineering background, me having a non-technical engineering background, but yet we both work with people like each other, right? We interface the non-tech and the tech. And so figuring out what this baseline of product marketing is and how we use it as a powerful catalyst to drive products forward. Product marketing, similar to the way you describe developer relations and in this Venn diagram, you spoke specifically that it's a lot of like overlapping between the technical and the marketing and then the communication side. Product marketing, in my perspective and my experience, has been a Venn diagram of sales, marketing, client services, and product. And starting out with trying to become a product expert first, like the product managers, to understand what the product is, what all the use cases are. And then it sort of becomes this kind of communication between client services and sales, which is, hey, these are the products that we're building. These are the use cases that your current customers will care about. And for the sales folks, here's a product market fit that we discovered. This is where you are. These are the target audiences you're looking to target. And this is the information you need, and sort of equipping them on both sides of the selling and the upselling strategy. And then with marketing is that piece, which is like, they're kind of like the legs to the communication aspect of all of this, which is developing an entire product marketing strategy, which empowers the rest of marketing. So it's kind of like the pre-step to like greater marketing and being more thoughtful about it. So instead of being very campaign to campaign focused and having one-offs, it's like, what's the bigger picture? What are we trying to accomplish? Where are we now? Where are we trying to go into the future? What is the current marketplace like? What are our competitors doing? What are the realities of the product? And then as a product marketer, me being able to put together a go-to-market strategy to inform all of these teams, give them just the right amount of information they need to take it and run with it, and then build more legs into the go-to-market strategy, which then the final goal is to get into the hands of customers. And one of the four goals that I measure with product marketing are awareness, adoption, retention, and growth. And I look at them in those four orders of product marketing first has to fulfill that need of, is number one, are all the target audiences aware of this product feature enhancement we're building? And then are they starting to adopt it and what can we do to help adopt those things. And then the more advanced you get with product marketing, depending on where you are at the company, what are we doing to retain the customers? Are we building a really great ecosystem to make them want to come back? And the fourth piece is the growth piece, which is, are we now in a position to be able to continue to grow these target audiences out to the max? And then also open it up to other target audiences that we can go after now that we're confident about the product market fit. And that's been my perspective of from doing product management and product marketing. And through all of those things, there's just so many ways of being able to drive innovation and being able to do it in a little bit more of a creative way than maybe I would say that like engineering teams or like product teams do, because I don't want to say that they're not creative. Everyone is creative. It's just that product marketing doesn't necessarily have to follow the discipline the way engineers do, where it's like you have to follow step by step to make sure the product is developed. You're in a unique position as a product marketer where you have this finished product, and then you're able to take a lot of liberties in terms of how you're going to be able to try to achieve those, you know, four goals of awareness, adoption, retention, and growth. So I'm going to pause there, and I'd love to sort of hear your feedback and your perspective of like how you have been interacting with product marketing and how you've been utilizing it for yourself in the roles that you have, especially with developer relations.
Yes. I think a lot of what you said resonates for me too. And I think a holistic approach to a product is at the very base of a product marketing manager. One example is one of my idols, Scott Monty of Ford, when he brought up an example of when they were making a car, the brake team, the people just focus on stopping the car, the brakes, they would say, hey, we're starting a new car, let's get in the room, and they would work on the brake system. And they would make sure the calipers were huge, they would make sure that it was like, has the most grip, the most friction to stop the car as fast as they could. And then another team would be focused on the engine. It was like, let's go as fast as we can, let's go all out, let's make the headers this large, let's make sure it has enough gas and the intake and the fuel fuel pump and all this stuff. And then by the time that the car was made, like they put all these pieces together, it'd be heavy, it'd be clunky, and nothing could work well together because it was never designed together. The brake system was overly brakey, so like it jerked the car hard to stop. It was extremely heavy, so it made the overall weight of the car so that it uses more gas. It just did not work well until they had a holistic approach. And I think a product marketing manager does that. Not only just says, hey, did you know they're doing this on the engine team? And did you know they're doing this on the braking team? Those don't work together well. If we're going to package this car, we need to make sure that it's not going to be too expensive and it's going to be good on gas mileage because that's what the users want. And so I understand this breaks really well, but like it actually will not, it's breaking more than what we need for this audience, and it's wasting more money because our audience is, they're not looking about how much it slows down. They want it, does it stop? And you're exceeding that checkbox, which is great. You're good at your job, but let's go back and let's focus on what the customer needs. And I think in terms of a product marketer, they just look at the product, look at the customer needs, and then they look to the future also. So like, how long will this car last? How will this be a good introduction to our next car or the next product that they would move up to after they've outgrown that car? And so to me, I think a product marketer sees the journey of the customer, looks at the product through their eyes, understands what people are working on, and just helps them refine with the feedback, because it's not like they're dumb. It's more like they're dealing with incomplete information. As we deal with the product and the customers, we help fill in those gaps so that the outcome is good for the company and good for the customer, and also plays well with all the other things so that the transition from one product to the other is natural, seamless, and is ideal for everyone involved.
I'm smiling because just from the inside out, I'm like, Wesley, where were you when I was on my product marketing teams? I would have loved to be able to work with you. You mentioned a very key thing, which is how a product marketer is this connector who's tying in all the efforts with all the different cross teams, specifically, I would say around products, and then, you know, also the business facing teams as well. And you mentioned something like being able to close the customer feedback loop and say, like, this is actually what the customers want, not what we think that they want. This is what they want, and this is what the product can help right now, but these are what the gaps are. And in a lot of the companies that I've worked at, even from startups all the way to big tech companies, depending on how fast the company was trying to move or how big it was, because there's just, it's also too large of like teams can also kind of slow down the ability to take a product to market and have the right communication. It was very challenging to be able to close that customer feedback loop, partly because so many of the teams were kind of out of step with each other. So it's like, things are kind of coming to product marketing when it's all completely done and it's like being thrown over the fence to them. And it's like, okay, take it, run with it and go. It's like, you're the quarterback and you caught the football. And then you're like, oh wait, where's the goalpost? Like, we did not really think this through, but at that point the product is developed and now the product marketer is saying things after the fact. Whereas if the teams were kind of in sync in the right ways, product marketing could have been a conduit for that really strong product development early on. And that's something I enjoy being able to like train a lot of like employees and cross teams on, because that little thing that you and I are talking about that you get, that I get, you with your engineering discipline of knowing the importance of following steps in a certain order, me having also experienced it from the pain of like how it's not, a lot of this is also not being necessarily taught to teams that are involved with go-to-market strategies. And I just think that that tiny like a piece of education can like really transform the way product marketing is done inside technology companies. And you and I were talking a little bit about the digital transformation era, from things like being in the pandemic right now and how we all are working remotely. And we're so interdependent on digital technology now. It's imperative now, right? It's not an option for us to be able to get these things right and understand what the steps are and where we fit in to be able to develop really good product, because we need to. Everyone needs good product. And a lot of these technology companies are going to continue to hire. They're one of like the they're a set of companies. Everyone's sort of been hit by this recession, but they're one of the ones who continue to hire. And that says something, that the demand in the market is that we are going more towards digital products. And so we have these two problems at hand. One is, how do we work well together to develop those products well? Number two, how do we make sure that the products are really good and well communicated for the customers that we're building for? Because there was a study and I don't know how you feel about it. I'd love your perspective too, where when I was at PayPal and there was like a set of like developers and directors I was speaking to, and they're like, does anyone know of like the 1,000 features that are on Microsoft Word, how many are actually used? And so I said, I raised my hand and I would say, I think like up to 10, but no more. And so the developer was like, you're absolutely right. It's somewhere between like 3 and 5 at the most that you use on a consistent basis, which sounds about right, even from my user experience, right? And there's just so much going on with digital products. And there's just a disconnect between how they're being developed and then how much the customers know of how much what has been developed can actually help them. And we need to raise awareness on that and be able to help companies and employees be able to close that gap. It's not an option anymore, right?
It's like the friend you brought up, the Office example of Word, and the reason why they moved to the ribbon interface for the Office suite of applications is because a lot of the feedback there or requests for features that the Office team was getting were features that were already in the product. It's just that the people who are using it couldn't discover them or find them because of the way that the interface is. And so they decided to go over the redo the interface. So they're like, we're not coming out with any new features, but we're just making the features we already have more discoverable and come up with wizards. So when you do find them, that we can walk you through on how to use them effectively. And I think that is definitely a point to it. But also, if I could talk about this other thing that you brought up, which goes into retention. And it ties directly to what you're saying when a product is thrown over the fence to a product marketer and they're like, here it is, go do your thing. And you don't have the input into shaping that product the way that it should before you're given the football to run towards the goalposts, as you put it. One thing is, I just want to give permission to people, like you're saying, that are getting hired into these positions. That is okay. It happens. It's okay. But you need two things in order to be successful in that position. One, you have to have the ability to be transparent. So you're going to see all of the issues when you get that football that wasn't seen when they developed it. And you should have the ability to be transparent about, like, here's the product. We know it doesn't do this. We know it doesn't do that. We know it doesn't do this, but it does this really well. And we have confidence here and we're going to lean into it and develop that. And so you have to be able to be transparent and show the product the way it is, all the warts and everything. Because if you're more genuine, then people would say, well, I know it's bad at this. They told me it's bad, but like, I still think it's good enough that I'm going to adopt it. So the marketer is not just to try to get people to use the product. It's going to get people to want to use the product. So there are people who have to use a product. And as soon as there's a healthy alternative, people jump ship really quickly. And they're like, wait, I thought we had millions of users. But like, it's very fragile. And if you make people have to use your product, as soon as they don't have to, they'll jump ship. So the way you measure success or satisfaction is the delta between expectations and reality. And if you can narrow that gap when you present it, all the best. The second part of that in terms of being a successful PMM is the people on the other side of the fence being able to make good on the promises you made on the other side. So like, you understand all these warts, you understand, you hear what needs to be changed. You weren't in that first process cycle, but they better include you in that second product cycle and when the development and emerging the feedback into actual bringing the product back into market. So that when it comes over the fence again, you're like, yes, this is what I expected. This is what people are looking for. And this is a marginal movement of the things that I said that we would change to our customer base.
Yeah, very well said. Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm curious if we can jump into how you've used product marketing to drive innovation with maybe a case story that you can share. I really loved your explanation of product marketing from your perspective as well. Mm-hmm. And so we've sort of established this baseline of what it is and what we're trying to use product marketing to accomplish. You've done so much in your career. Can we talk about like maybe one thing to dive deeper into?
Yes. I'll talk about a failure, if that's okay.
That is totally fine. In the spirit of being transparent, right?
Yes. And so I was at Atlassian and I was hired to be the PMM for HipChat. Have you heard of HipChat?
I have. I got to say Atlassian is one of my favorite software as a services. I'm just going to be a fangirl for a second. I love the concept of it. And I also love the execution and how they've evolved over time. Like the Jira component of Atlassian is like this engineering management tool for companies that run on the agile method. And then they sort of have like my other favorite tool, which is Confluence, which is these wiki pages to be able to help both non-tech and tech teams understand what's going on. And then HipChat, which I was also using 5-6 years ago before Slack came out. It was similar to Slack, I want to say. And
absolutely.
I haven't used it for a while, but it was nice to have all of it sort of together, right? Because if I'm in one ecosystem, I don't care to use like Skype or AIM or all of these other like instant messages when I can kind of have it all in one place. So yeah, I'm familiar with HipChat and I did love the concept to its execution.
So HipChat was an acquisition of Atlassian. It was a startup and purchased, and then became a very good glue for all of Atlassian's products. So Jira tickets, you can deep link Confluence pages, the snippets, everything was kind of like, you can talk about a project, you can make your own project space and then destroy them when you're done. And when, if something is an emergency, you need to pull in all these people who aren't on your team. It was a great way to like make a workspace really quickly. I loved HipChat, loved it. And I was brought in because Slack was starting to eat their lunch. You're like, everyone loves Slack. How come they're not jumping on HipChat? Kind of like Zoom is to Skype. Like Skype's been around forever, but Zoom is for taken up into the right for some reason. So what happened? So like, HipChat was kind of like in the Skype space. Like people knew them who didn't know them, but there's a shiny new thing that everyone was jumping onto. And so when I started, first thing I did is I identified the loyal customer base, like the people who are using it even after this shiny thing has come out. And then after defining and rallying them in terms of giving them the tools they need to evangelize the product, like here are ways that you can talk to other people about what we do and why we're so good, and giving them a voice, like recognition, saying, hey, we see you, thank you so much for supporting us, to help solidify the base and get loyalty. And then there is a faction, of course, that we all deal with when we're marketers, of people who absolutely hate our product. So it's not just making a post and then people are hearing about it, but those other people who come in and like, oh, look at them making this post saying they're doing it. They're just copying Slack. You know, those people who are haters and detractors. So engaging them. So understanding their nature of what they didn't like, what they're criticizing, and what would make them happy in their eyes. So one, validating them. So that's one thing that's left out, is you have to validate the people who don't like your product. Because they're not stupid also, and they probably are a fountain of knowledge. And actually, the people who don't like your product are one of the most people who are almost super advocates if you listen to them. So you can just make zero changes, but say, we hear you. Oh, that is valid. Thank you for pointing that out. And people are like, well, okay, I guess we're not arguing anymore. And then they're like, well, it's not good at this. And then they understand the talking points. And then they kind of like shift to, instead of criticizing things they don't like, but also evangelizing the things that they do like. So basically
what you're saying, it's very powerful. The way you're saying it is you can turn your haters or the people that are not happy with the product into your biggest champions and ambassadors of your product by, number one, acknowledging them first, and then sort of like creating a conversion funnel, if you will, of like, thank you for pointing out our shortcomings. We're going to make you part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And then that empowers them even more, where it's like, yeah, like now I'm kind of designing my own reality with you in this product. Like I'm on board. Let's see what we can do to collaborate. Right. So you took this user base that is just like, oh my God, like this is so painful, into your catalyst now, into mm-hmm. kind of creating your next product sprint and developing out the product better.
Yeah, like you've heard of, there's a thin line between love and hate. And so the people who are most vocal about the detractors show two things. One is that they're passionate, maybe on the other side, but they have that passion. And two, they have initiative and they want to use their voice. And those are two powerful things that if they're on the wrong side can hurt you. But if you move them on the right side, they are not only really good advocates for you, but then they recognize their own past community and they're able to talk to them too on the same level and with the same type of like, I used to be you, and they can relate to that. So it's important it's just like the reason why, like if you are in a relationship and then you break up, that person might really, who have really loved you, really hate you, that can work in the reverse. And so identifying those people, and I'm not saying like listen to everything they say or that they're 100% right, but validate them as humans and that they have opinions and that they're worth listening to. Maybe not worth doing what they're saying, but just, you know, say like, you have opinions, it's based on logic, and I can see how in your use case, that totally makes sense for our product to do that in your use case, even though it's not the bulk of our use cases of what we aim for. But just, you know, validate them, and then allows them to move past that one thing and onto the next thing that they're passionate about. And then as they move down that run, you're like, okay, well, that actually, we see that too. And our users are asking it. And so let's do that. And then they feel validated that you can, once you get past that hurdle, you can move back. And I started off saying this is like not a success story because I was with HipChat and not Slack. But the other part in terms of an ecosystem is that some people who make products feel that their products are used in a vacuum. I use Word. They are going to be using Word in all of the company. No, some of them are going to be using Google Docs, you know? You have to...
Or both, right?
Or both, right? And so you have to realize that people use multiple products and even your products in conjunction with others. So one thing that made sure to help in terms of the space, like the journalists, was that it wasn't HipChat versus Slack. And so I did a lot of work reaching out to our competitor, Slack, so that we were frenemies. Like we were saying, hey, we both have the same passions in terms of helping people be more productive, making people who are away feel more connected to their teams. And so when Slack had their first year, like their 1 year anniversary, I flew out to San Francisco. I went to their office and I brought a cake saying, congratulations. Welcome to like, You guys are doing an amazing job. Can't wait to see what you do next. And so like we had a nice relationship, and eventually in terms of like going through that, Slack eventually acquired HipChat, and in their merger, they announced that that relationship and how we were still working together, even though we're working on the same amount, same audience, is why they determined that they decided to move forward with the relationship and keep that going. And so that ultimately was good for the product, even though the product died, but it was subsumed or like integrated into Slack, and that same philosophy continued. The part that I feel that where I failed is that we were chasing the coolness. And the people who thought Slack was cool stayed with Slack. And they knew that it was just going to be a shiny new thing as new versions came out. So they had that reputation piece. HipChat tried to acquire their customer base rather than acquiring their own customer base of business users, traditional business users, where we were already big and we didn't grow that. Instead, we tried to grow, instead of growing here, we tried to put another dot on the map and then grow that. And so growing from our center core was not something that we did. And that was a huge, huge negative for us. And that is not for a lack of trying, but a lack of, let's say, vision as a PMM that I failed to impart to get some of the people who would love our product as is and grow that space instead of chasing the competitor's tail, which I think is also a problem that a lot of execs and higher ups want to do, saying they're successful in this area. Why can't we do that?
Let me make sure that I understand like what you're explaining. HipChat was acquired by Atlassian, but then you also said that then HipChat got folded into Slack. Like if
years later. Yeah. This happened like what, last year, a year and a half ago.
Okay. Yeah. So then was it Atlassian that then sold HipChat to Slack?
Yep. Oh, no. Atlassian gave HipChat to Slack and then also did an investment into Slack. It's not as if Slack paid for it. HipChat traded it for equity share into Slack. But that relationship wouldn't have happened unless they had a good feeling about each other, a good camaraderie in terms of like being in the space together, that could happen. So it wasn't an aggressive takeover like you've seen. It was more of like a friendly, hey, we both care about the users, let's move forward. And so that happened last year or so. And I left Atlassian, I think 2015. So this was like 5 years ago. Like I could see the writing on the wall, and I try to move us in that direction of like, let's focus on our customer base. And that is a battle I lost internally. And I think even though it did not get the market share that I think it should have in the areas that it would have gotten adoption. It still ultimately found another life at another company because we were able to focus on these specific relationships that were important.
That makes sense. I also wouldn't deem you as having failed. This is just, it's one of those interesting things too, where it's like, how do you, it's, we're never like one man shows or one woman shows when it comes to being able to sort of drive some sort of strategy. Like, I've had to learn also that it's like my ability to convince like leadership and cross teams to be able to try to go after a strategy is just as important as the strategy itself. So I think maybe, you know, that also sort of goes into it. I think product strategy is like so important when it comes to product development and product marketing, because good product strategy enables strong competitive development, which then enables really good product marketing, because the focus of who your core base was began from the beginning of this whole development versus sort of like kind of figuring it out towards the middle or the end, when your decision making at that point is just a lot more limited than maybe at the beginning when you're scoping all the products out and being able to do that. So,
and it's the first customer problem that we were talking about.
Yeah. It's like, it's okay to sort of have like a smaller product market fit when you start out. But I think in sort of like the development of the product over a period of time, like you kind of hit your midpoint, and that's when you should have enough data on in terms of who your larger core base or your core product market fit is, and then how you should be expanding from there. And it's hard. I think these are things that I really like to do on episodes like this, which is just be transparent with people and explain to them that product marketing, product management, product strategy, they're all really fun things to be a part of, but it's also very challenging as well, because it is these things. You have to try to convince so many different cross teams. You will have leadership who is also kind of getting pressure from their board in terms of like, well, this competitor is doing this. What are you guys doing to, you know, turn the ship around and make sure that you can beat them? And it's tricky because sometimes it's not just trying to make short-term moves, but also trust in the strategy that it can succeed and yield results long-term as well. And that's hard. Time is always against us when we're in agile technology, because you're supposed to constantly be iterating really, really fast. It's not a bad thing to move fast, but
you should think if you should, right? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And that's in the right area.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that it's the ability to understand when you should be utilizing these things. When do you move fast? When do you not? And, you know, time and time again, I'm just like, why can't companies, just the product team, spend a little bit more time on the scoping part? Like, we're going to have our 2-week sprints. In the case of like a place like Facebook, where they move super fast, the sprints can be like 5-day sprints or 3 to 5-day sprints. But if you dedicate like a 4 to 8 hour workshop, like when you're scoping a product, like on the first day of a sprint, there's so much time, money, effort you can save and be able to maximize results and scale that. So I don't understand why we're not doing that collectively as product professionals and inside technology companies. I mean, do you agree with that? Because that's has been one of my continuous observations over and over. And I'm just kind of like, just scratching my head. Like, why is this happening? Like, why didn't we kind of account for this when we were scoping?
Yeah, that usually happens when you see someone leave a company and they're hiring a new person. Like, oh, this is a mess. We're getting this person out of here. And the person says, all right, so what are we doing? And where are we? And they do that work inherently as part of their job. But the person, I mean, just doing it regularly will keep you from having to flip and get new people in, because they say, well, okay, this doesn't make sense. I'm going to make it make sense. If people are able to take a step back and just say, okay, let's just see where we are. Let's see where we're going, and let's see what projects are going on and make sure they're aligned. I think a lot of companies don't initiate that because things haven't blown up enough. Like, there are some problems, but we'll just keep going. Let's not make any changes. All right, Bill knows what he's doing. Let's just let Bill do his thing. And then Karen's got this going on, but I mean, it's still kind of like, we're still getting some productivity out of her and some work out of there. And then you get all this stuff, and then you're like, whoa, wait. Okay, I've lost track of what everyone's doing and what the message is. And then that's, we talked about product marketers and being able to say, hey, what are you all doing? Let's get this working together. And if everyone was able to not just stop and see, but being able to talk to each other and realize that they're working on something similar. Like there, sometimes there are two teams working on the same thing. And they're like, we got to get forward because we're going to get it out. And they're both doing that in this direction. And there's some overlap and you can reuse some of this, but some of it's just incompatible. There'd be a lot less waste if people just stopped, came together and just like cards on the table. This is what we're doing. Here are the problems. I've had people in companies who says, you know, like, this is what I'm working on. I'm really stuck on this and I've been working on it for weeks. And then someone says like, oh yeah, I ran into that problem at a previous job, another project, do this. And it unblocks that person, right? So the sharing of knowledge and working in terms of like together or transparently so that everyone can see what someone's doing, it needs like a taskmaster, an orchestrator to be able to say, we just need to hold off on everything right now and just do an evaluation and see where we are. Make sure that we all agree of where we're going and make sure that we're not just going the same direction, but using the same map, right? So everyone road can map. Take side roads, everyone can take highways, but we can figure out like, make sure that we're all moving in the same direction in the same way. So that we don't seem like we're 50 different teams with the same company name, but we are working together to get to that goal. So I totally agree with you. You're 100% right.
So you just say you, and I love the way you eloquently say things, which is like the last part where you just said, you know, not be 50 different teams is don't be a silo. Like we, and you talk about like so many teams taking their own routes, which is like, ultimately, you can, you know, do things your own way, right? I don't have a right to tell you how you put your code together. You don't necessarily maybe care how I put together my go-to-market strategy. As long as we understand our core requirements and we know the bigger roadmap that we're moving towards. And, you know, the other thing you mentioned, which is like, can someone have the courage and the bravery? And I really do believe that it has to kind of come from the leadership level. It's to be like, let's just stop and like, let's look at the roadmap and let's assess it. That should be happening towards the end of the year or the beginning of the year, like for H1, H2s of like product development. But it doesn't necessarily happen for one reason or another. And that's just because people are most likely, most teams are just kind of concerned with delivering their products out and they don't want to get it, stuck in a webs of like, oh, well, I got to wait for person A or B or C to figure this out before I can go build my thing out. And that will adversely affect my performance review or what have you. But, you know, if a leader is looking at this all the way from the top where it's like, why don't we take fear out of the equation here? If we want to have a really strong product marketing strategy overall for the company that will drive impact, market share, and revenue. And why don't we just like have everyone just be honest and open up what's going on, what they suggest and like, what can we agree on and simplify, right? You don't have to compensate and move fast and break things and move forward on multiple things. You can focus on like 3 to 5 product pillars at the most and be able to break out from that. Because I think what people don't understand, whether you're coming into these roles or overall, when you're at the 50,000 foot view at the leadership level, they don't see what's happening in the trenches. And what happens is that Agile is a really great methodology to develop products because you're constantly iterating. But it also, every sprint that you have requires so much homework, right? Of like all the meetings that have to take place, all the back and forth that you have to do, these conversations you need to have. So if you're going to be 50 different teams inside of one company and take that method, it's not going to scale. How about if we were 50 teams that focus on 5 product fillers and like 10 teams each focus on one and we were able to scale that way and it was less meetings, more time to think strategically, more time to collaborate in the right way, create less work, but create more effective work, right? That's what I'm sort of like, that's kind of like my holy grail and my product marketing nirvana that I like to influence companies and like cross teams on as I'm sort of sitting down with them is like, this is attainable. This is possible. You can create this reality. We have a little bit of a ways to go, but don't discourage yourself from being able to get there, because I want your opinion on this too. And I'm going to say this one last thing is that when you're moving that fast and you're doing so many things, you and I as human beings and anyone as a human being, I don't care if you're an individual contributor or you're all the way at the leadership level, when you're just constantly moving this fast and doing so much as a human being, you know, it's burning you out. We created technology to help us. We didn't create technology to emulate technology and to sort of give up on our human aspect, right? And to become these robots and work like 18, 20 hour days. It was supposed to be vice versa. We are creating all these tools to help us automate, to work more intelligently, and to improve the quality of the product that we're developing. And quite frankly, the quality of our lives too. Because I've been in those situations where I've had to work 16, 18 hour days. And it's like, you know, you come back home, you got to quickly scarf down dinner and then like start all over again and just try to finish from, because you were in meetings all day, right? And you were jumping from meeting to meeting. So you didn't actually get to check your 300 emails that are sitting in the inbox, and you didn't actually get to take time to do the work. And this is also one of those unspoken truths of what's sort of going on right now in like digital technology development. And I want to pause there, and I want your perspective too, because you've been an engineer. I mean, I'm giving my non-technical perspective, but you know, I want to hear your technical perspective as well on all of this.
So funny you mentioned technical, because I think in technology, that's one of the things that for products, at least on the C-suite executive level, a lot of it is focused on what it can do, what its value, and what they can change in the positive. But on the engineering level, a lot of how we decide to go forward for people who are in the technical realm are the constraints, right? Okay, so this cable cannot push video out that fast, or this focus length can only zoom in this far, or this packet is how many we can store, this is the size of the disk, this is the web browser's limitation. So there's a lot of limitations that we do, or people who are in engineering do, to figure out how to move forward, because they have a lot of constraints that they worry about. I think in business, they should also factor in people in terms of their constraints of moving a project forward, of saying like, okay, we want to deliver this on a wide scale, but we don't want people to have to download anything. We don't want people to have to go through a lengthy install process. But we have to deliver this on a date that our teams won't burn out. So Bob, he's having a baby soon. Laura is going to have an adoption. Bill has nothing coming up, but he's been working so hard. We need to get him to go on a vacation, or Jamie or John or whatever. They have lives. They have things that they have to juggle. And so in terms of constraints, that should be built into the person of understanding, and then go back and saying, okay, here's what we're building, and here are the resources, and a fully articulated like vision and detail of our resources in order to produce the product. And so you can either reduce scope to bring the timeline closer, or you can make it robust, but still move the time out and still produce what you want to do. And depending on, especially if you're agile, you can plan to build up to that larger release. And you can also plan to like understand what people are doing and say, here are the resources that we have to do this thing. And people are resources. People are human. People are sometimes unpredictable. So build that into the schedule, build that into the product, and understand that if people are happier because you're not burning them out, you have less turnover, which means you're not hiring new people that get them up to speed. And people are loyal, just like the detractors, and there's a thin line. And every person that you let go, they could be an enemy saying, oh, I was at X and X company and I hated it. Have people come into your company, understand what the product is, understand your limitations, give them great expectations, and then have a good offboarding process. So in the future, if there needs to be a merger in place or a reacquisition, that you still are on a good ground. So it works with products and it works with people and it works how companies operate.
And I think the one thing to highlight, and a lot of the important things you said too, is also give these employees the ability to onboard, you know, have some sort of time to do that, because there was a lot of research I went through. I did work in a background screening and onboarding company, and I had to read through like why onboarding was so important. And good onboarding retains like over 80% of employees. And by giving them proper onboarding, they're much more higher performing early on, and you'll retain them long term, and they'll be helping you drive, be able to drive the revenue and be able to hit the goals, which when you really think about it as a human being that's grounded, it's like, well, what does that mean? It means that you allowed me to learn about what the company is, the business model, what the products are, who we're serving, how we're different, and, you know, what is my specific role in being able to drive these things. It's not hard to do that, but I just think that in the speed and the sort of like you need to hit the ground running, sort of like this expectation, that whole onboarding is sort of skipped out between like 0 to 30 mm-hmm. to 60 or even 90 days. And that's, you know, one of the big pain points, which leads to like lots of frustrations for employees when, instead of being frustrated, they could have been empowered early on, right? And had the ability to kind of absorb and ask the questions they needed versus sort of be like super fast. Like we need you to be agile in your onboarding to the point where it's like, you're skipping all these steps that are critical for your knowledge to be able to succeed long-term, kind of happens there too. And that's sort of unspoken. And we need to, as product professionals, be able to address that as well and close the gaps for that. Because when you have better onboarding, you'll have better employees, happier employees, better company culture, better product strategy development, and being able to take a product to market, which the customers will love too, right? It's almost like this professional karma, sort of like this energy that you're allowing everyone to sort of start out with and be able to hold, develop a healthy momentum to get to be in a good cycle over and over, develop good products.
Especially at times like these where you have tragedies where companies are laying off people or people are taking pay cuts. Onboarding in terms of giving them a perspective of the greater purpose of not only their job, but the company, is one of the main drivers for retention too, and satisfaction of people understanding, like, this is not just what I do and I'm getting satisfaction of accomplishing a task, but I'm working for a company whose greater purpose is to push this big agenda or make a dent into this thing that I care about. And if no one is told what the company stands for, what they're doing and why they're doing the mission statement, and if that's kind of just glossed over, it's you're losing that piece, especially in times when things aren't well and things aren't going well.
Yeah, because a lot of companies truthfully are also kind of going through reorging and massive layoffs and then rehires. And so like all of these things that we talked about throughout this episode are just so important, and you can't skip any of this, right? If you mm-hmm. want to rebuild your workforce as a leader for your company, these are all important things that you need to account for in your plan, right? Of how do we ensure not just being around for 6 months or a year, but, you know, 3 to 5 years and 10 years, like how do we iterate and build on solid things versus iterating and building on like, development that was not thoughtful to begin with, and that is sort of creating us to alleviate fires versus sort of like having this, you know, positive upward trajectory.
And also being really clear about your mission and your objectives can sometimes signal what you can bring to a company that aligns with what their intention is. So less about the products, more about the mission and the intention, which includes and kind of dovetails into inclusion and diversity in a company, so that you can bring these ideas and that you can actually truly be innovative, because you are taking things that may have not come up before, maybe in your personal life, maybe your hobbies, or maybe your background, that you can then bring that to work to help fulfill that vision. To really brainstorm and move a product in a way that wasn't even thought of before because of your essence in a company.
That it's so well spoken. I feel like you could do such a great like a speaking event where you'd be able to like lead a bunch of leaders in the C-suite to help them understand that. Thank you so much for these invaluable insights. And I want to ask you, like, if there's anything else you want to wrap up with, any important closing points. You've said so many great things, and I'm excited to share your message across the B2B tech audience, and B2C is welcome too.
Yes.
But lots of like that wisdom over such a really great illustrious career that you've had. Anything else you want to share?
Kind of what I would like to say is related to diversity and inclusion. And if you look at my background, it's kind of like, this is not the best in terms of presenting an image, but I hope people aren't focusing on what's going around me, but instead of focusing on what I'm saying.
The background's cool, by the way.
Thanks.
I want to play with those toys.
I just want to encourage people not to judge too much on packaging. Look at substance, look at vision, look at potential. So even if someone is very junior, look at what they could be and what they could do instead of like looking for the thing that they think looks like success. In this world of digital transformation, like we mentioned before, if you look at the history of like back in the 60s and 70s, what an office looked like, what success looked like, and to now, to hoodies and people who are speaking the truth, we are moving to a more genuine way of being and it being the right way. So to stand out is not to look at the shiny thing in the past necessarily, but to be able to embrace differences of the now and move in the direction that makes sense rather than saying the paradigm of what successful is what was in the was the formula that was used before. So be able to be brave, look into a direction that may not be evident, but do understand if things are seeming more natural, more relational, that is where we're going. And this is the trend in a large arc and just not just now. So don't let things that seem or give signaling in the past of chaos or not being professional in a way shield you for something that could be really great.
That's really powerful. Essentially, what I'm gathering from you is that, you know, we have to sort of overcome any of our maybe internal perspectives, number one, of what perfection was and what we think it should be in the present and the future. Number two, it's like, how do we become unafraid and bold to develop to create or co-create our present and our future based off of this very rapidly point in history that we're in, where everything is changing so fast, and especially in technology where we move at the speed of light, you know, like every hour things are constantly changing as opposed to maybe other sectors. And in that case, the good of that innovation is that, yeah, there aren't models. You have to constantly create that, right? And for the entrepreneur, for the visionary, it's very exciting because we're not sort of getting stuck on, well, you know, I think success has to look like me creating like a social network in my basement, or maybe I have to be the next Slack or the HipChat. It can be so much more because there's so many use cases out there. There's so many problems out there. And your more or your way of doing something different has not been invented yet. And you just have to sort of shed away the fear and you have to go after it. And this is why I love to do what I do, is that I'm constantly interfacing with people like you, where we all get that and we embody that, where it's like, I was joking to you earlier, life is agile and things are constantly changing. And how do we embrace those changes, and how do we bring about change in a way that makes sense for ourselves, for everyone? It can be healthy, it can be motivational, and it can create just really positive outcomes for us in ways, you know, that we didn't necessarily think could be a product or service. So that's where we are in history right now, and it's super exciting.
Yeah. More constraints are happening every day, and so time for innovation right now. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And with that, I'm going to end this episode. And Wesley, I think one more thought is, if anyone's interested in following any of your work, where would they be able to reach out to you?
I'm Wesley83 on most places. In terms of chatting and just saying hi, Wesley83 on Twitter is the best place to reach me. If you want to move forward with like a business relationship, I'm on LinkedIn, of course, linkedin.com/in/Wesley83. You can find me there and a little bit of my work history. But I would prefer people to reach out to me on Twitter. Let's have a conversation. Let's get to know each other before we understand if we're a good fit together. So just let's chat. I'm very approachable.
Awesome. Very cool. Thank you so much. And I'll put all of that information on the description as well. Thank you, everyone.